let me welcome you to the second national meeting of the Society. Actually, we're not really sure whether we should call this the first or the second national meeting, because last year, although we had a national meeting, there was still some question as to whether we had a Philadelphia Society. We did have an organizing committee at that time, however, we had no members. But since that meeting was so successful last year, the organizing committee has been turned into a board of trustees, and we now have a total of 76 members. And by the time the national meeting is held next year, I hope we will have a much more flourishing society than we have even this year. As you can see, we have quite a good turnout. I will have more to say on the subject of the Philadelphia Society tomorrow at lunch. This is really all I want to say on the matter at this time. The topic for this year's meeting, as you know, is civil rights and individual responsibility. Now, this was selected by the Board of Trustees in consultation with the people who attended a regional meeting of the Society in Philadelphia in October. So I hope this will answer some of the questions I've been asked. Yes, we have had meetings of the Philadelphia Society in Philadelphia. We all agreed that the obvious points that civil rights is one of the great issues of the day, comparable, I suppose, to the issue of Vietnam and on the international scene. But on the other hand, it seems to be an issue that seldom, if ever, discussed at length by conservative societies. And we felt the time had come for an extensive examination and discussion of this subject. Who knows, we may even be able to come up with some useful contributions to national policy in this area. In any event, it was our feeling that we certainly shouldn't let the left wing monopolize the field. Now let me say on this point, in case any of you feel that this is a far out subject for the Philadelphia Society to concern itself with, the number of interesting things have been happening recently in this country. A member of the Board of Trustees of the Philadelphia Society is apparently about to be enshrined as a patron saint of the Great Society. I refer, of course, to our colleague Milton Friedman. Apparently, Sergeant Shriver and Lyndon Johnson are about to pile a negative income tax on top of all our other poverty programs. Now, Hubert Humphrey recently, of course, has emerged as a hardline anti-communist. Hubert better be careful or somebody will accuse him of harboring John Birch Society sympathies. Actually, a funny thing happened to me on the way to Chicago. Just before leaving, I was handed the current issue of a booklet called the New Individualist Review, which I find the lead article of the New Individualist Review sets out to prove that Herbert Hoover was a dangerous left-winger. And I quote from this article, along with the whiskey on the flight yesterday afternoon, where it really passed the time for me. And I quote, "Far from being a libertarian, Hoover was a statist par excellence in economics and in morals. Also, I found that he was the first establishment man." Now, perhaps I should reintroduce myself at this time. My name is Campbell. I'm director of the institution at Stanford University that was founded by that dangerous left-winger. At any rate, there is one advantage, I think, from all this, and it's the next time we apply for a Ford Foundation grant, I'm going to send this article along as Exhibit A. Now we come to the important part of the program. It's my great pleasure to introduce the gentleman who will chair the opening session this afternoon, Professor Warren Nutter of the University of Virginia. Professor Nutter is a friend of many years standing, and I think I might also say comrade in arms. I would say roommate, but I'm a little afraid to say that. I'll say office mate. It might conjure up wrong interpretation. In the campaign of the fall of 1964, believe it or not, we shared an office for 2 months and actually got along pretty well, I would say. Now, well, enough said about that campaign. Let me now turn the chair over to Professor Nutter, Professor of Economics at the University of Virginia.
Thank you very much, Glenn. If your introduction proved nothing else, it showed how tolerant I am. I'm very pleased to open the meeting, this second Chicago meeting of the Philadelphia Society. A friend of mine asked me the other day, he said, what kind of an organization is this? Anyhow, it's named after Philadelphia and it always meets in Chicago. It sounds like it's a little bit confused. And I suggested, well, confused, perhaps a little harsh as a term, unconventional is a better description. But the meeting in Chicago does seem now to be a habit. A year has passed since we met here last, and one might say of that year what the Polish peasant said when he was asked by a communist official, Kolega, how do you find things this year? And he paused for a moment, and finally he said, I'd say middling, Kolega. And he was asked then, middling, what do you mean by that? And he said, things are worse than last year, but better than next. And I think this applies to me. Last year, I was asked to speak on a subject for which I had absolutely no qualifications. In fact, I'd proved my complete lack of qualification. I was asked to tell people how to persuade. Now, it's a different story this year when the topic is civil rights, which doesn't mean that anymore, but it's come to mean something about minority problems. And in this particular area, I refuse to bow to anyone as more expert on the question than I am. I can't remember the day when I wasn't in some minority or other. And you can just name it. Go down the line. Religion, nationality of origin, political affiliations, beliefs, social groups, professional colleagues, and all the rest. I've always been in a minority. I can't qualify for one that's now become the main issue, but I think it's an exception. But in any event, what's the result? Well, the result is that I'm asked to chair a session, which is to say that I'm told to keep my mouth shut and sit down and let the speakers take care of the business. And that's what I intend to do. I'm speaking now to allow you to have time to settle down and let the speakers write up their notes. But before I sit down, I do feel I'd like to take advantage of prerogative as chairman. After all, Mr. Campbell indulged in a little speech, and read to you a little piece that might serve to introduce this subject to some extent. It may be painful, but if we were to go back more than a year to this same city in the fall of 1964, there was an election campaign going on, and one of the candidates chose this city to face the issue of civil rights and to make a speech on that subject. I might say he was the only candidate who did so, but in any event, those who helped frame this speech are here today, and I think they'll recognize some of the words that I'm about to utter. Not very many other people will, because like most of the other speeches in that campaign, the words didn't reach very many ears. They did impress some, however, on the other side. I think Teddy White was very impressed by this particular endeavor. Well, let me read you a short excerpt. I can't give it all the feeling it's supposed to have, but it goes as follows. You often hear it said that the freedom of a member of a minority is violated when some barriers keeps him from associating with others in his society. But this is wrong. Freedom of association is a double freedom, or it is nothing at all. It applies to both parties who want to associate with each other. And so the barriers infringe the freedom of everybody in the society, not just the minorities. Now the removal of such barriers enhances freedom. That is clear. But it is equally clear that freedom is diminished when barriers are raised against the freedom not to associate. We must never forget that the freedom to associate means the same thing as the freedom not to associate. It is wrong to erect legal barriers against either side of that freedom. We are forced to only one conclusion. As far as the government is concerned, it must ensure freedom of association. But it cannot and should not ensure association itself. That is a matter that must be mutually and freely decided by the individuals involved. It is a matter of the heart and conscience. We only cloud the issue by labeling this as a problem of civil rights. A man's civil rights are those that he has in relation to his government, not in relation to his fellow men. Of course, government should not discriminate among citizens on irrelevant grounds, such as color, creed, or religion. But the fundamental issue of our day, and I'm going to conclude, is a different one. It is the issue of unfair discrimination in the private affairs of men. Here, government can provide no solution. No law can make one person like another if he doesn't want to. Government can do no more than offer moral leadership and persuasion. The ultimate solution lies in the hearts of men. Well, I offer that to you by way of stirring up perhaps some discussion. Now, the procedure is going to be as follows. We have two speakers here today. Storms over Mississippi prevented Mr. Perry from getting here. So Mr. Vandenhaag and Reverend Casserly will speak. They will have a little more time, which I think they're grateful for, although we dragged out in typical fashion and started late. After they're finished, there'll be time for discussion from the floor. I think it would be best to let them complete their discussion before we open it to the floor. Professor Vandenhaag, as you all know, is at New York University. The places in which he studied read like a travelogue, make one envious, and hope that he learned as much academically as otherwise. I see from his vita that his studies included Florence, Naples, and Sorbonne, and I'm sure they added greatly to his culture. He also received a more ordinary degree from Iowa State University, and I presume that's in Ames, because I always get those confused. That's at Iowa City. It's the State University of Iowa. I guess it's at Ames. And his PhD from New York University. his qualifications include practice as a psychoanalyst, and I hope he won't take advantage of that in commenting on my introduction. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Nussbaum.